This is Common Sense Radio. Straightforward and no excuses.
All right. Come on now.
This is the Steve Gruber Show.
Call me crazy.
Ooh, yeah.
What I said was perfectly right and spot on accurate.
Boy's got a mouth like a cannon, always shooting it all.
Stop. Yeah, stop. I mean, you're way off script.
Got it in me. Gonna quit until it all comes out.
Hey, boy.
Yeah, you know, it's not cynical, it's common sense.
Pay attention to me when I'm talking to you.
I'm gonna rock the nation. Rock the nation.
Genuine, accountable, and raw. Here is Steve Gruber.
If you're just plugging in, it is Free for All Friday. Thanks for climbing aboard the train. We're leaving the station now. You can call in. 888-900-9966, 888-900-9966. I look forward to your input on this Free for All Friday. The Common Sense Hotline open for your input. Tough news to start this second hour. The news that the family of Alexander and Sasha Pinskowski hoped would never come. The siblings, the brother and sister, standing in line at the Delta ticket gate in Brussels to check in for their flight to New York. Alexander was talking to his mother on the phone when the line went dead. They were not heard from again. 3 days later, word has come from Belgian authorities. That these people are not among the living. They asked for continued prayers, but the stories are emerging of loved ones struggle to know more. But it seems that Sasha and Alexander were among those killed in Brussels. Among the more than 300 maimed and murdered by Islamic terrorists. Radical Islamic terrorists. And there are others on the list from America. Bart Magome from Athens, Georgia. His girlfriend checked to make sure that he made it to the train. And it arrived at the airport at 7:30. It had his flight back to America scheduled at 10:30. I don't think he ever made it, she said. I've not heard from him, neither have his family. They've been to the hospitals, everywhere they can think of, but they've not heard from Bart. They say he was a good communicator. He had booked his flight to come back to the States. So more pain, more heartbreak, more devastation and bloodshed in the name of Islam, in the name of the Prophet. And we twiddle our thumbs for the most part, it seems. In fact, we do worse, it seems, than twiddle our thumbs. It seems that our president is tone deaf. He has not one clue how to behave when a world tragedy occurs. Instead of doing the right thing and getting on Air Force One and coming back to Washington to deal with what is really Belgium's 9/11, no, he stays in Cuba at the behest of a dictator, a two-bit dictator, I might add, and goes to a baseball game where he does the wave. Yeah, he sits there with Raul Castro, watching a baseball game. He twiddles away the time. He made his cursory little statement about the Brussels bombings and, you know, remaining strong and eradicating ISIS and blah, blah, blah. Who cares? He was even filmed laughing and joking and carrying on joyfully. Can you imagine if Tony Blair or Prime Minister Michel of Belgium, more accurately, if they had just gone to a soccer match, you know, the afternoon of 9/11 and, you know, just waved and carried on and played, or, you know, even after San Bernardino and just played and laughed and carried on. You know, Obama said something about, you know, not responding with fear, blah, blah, blah. What a joke. If the British Prime Minister or the Belgian Prime Minister had done anything remotely like that, we would have gone bananas, and rightfully so. The President of the United States, at least before this president, has been considered the leader of the free world and therefore the leader of NATO. Belgium, being a member of NATO, you would think that Barack Obama has something more substantial to offer, to say, to do, a better image. But no, he's eating hot dogs and doing the wave and watching a baseball game in the sun with his sunglasses on, kicked back and having a big old time. And it's just like so much of his foreign policy, it smacks of that old adage, leading from behind with a hot dog. You know, he's something about getting on with your normal life. You know, we are strong, our values are right. Nothing. This does nothing except embolden terrorists to do more. It emboldens these people to do more because they are empowered now because they know that our president is a weakling. They know that our president, rather than be bothered from his golf game or a good day out at the ballpark, he'll just go ahead and continue doing that. Because he can't be bothered. He's having too much fun with Air Force One. He's having too much fun being president. All these people running around when he snaps his fingers. And they talk about the narcissism of Donald Trump. Good God. Look at the TV. Donald Trump's narcissism? Donald Trump's arrogance? Please. Donald Trump could get lessons from this guy. ISIS does have power over us, Mr. President, because of their incredibly violent attacks on people, the fear they're putting into people. The United States is certainly not immune to this. I mean, if they see the United States president kicked back and relaxed, what's to be concerned about? Do you remember when James Foley had his head sawed off? You know, Obama made his quick speech. It was dreadful. And, you know, minutes later, he was teeing off on the golf course and laughing with some mates. Remember that? With his friends. He was just hanging out. James Foley got his head sawed off on a video, passed all over the world. But Barack, 7 minutes later, couldn't be deterred from his tee time. Tee time's more important. And for the record, he's a lousy golfer. He's terrible. Just lousy. All right, let's quickly get to Frank on the line. Frank, welcome to Free for All Friday.
Hi, Steve. You sure got him pegged. Did you see what he did yesterday?
Hard to say.
Our great commander-in-chief did the tango yesterday in Argentina. He was partying and doing the tango. And only Fox apparently covered it. But it was an absolute disgrace. All this stuff is going on, and this guy's partying on. And today, the commander of the free world is going to the Antilles Island. He's going to have fun at a resort today.
No,
so
why wouldn't
partying
he?
On, you know, when it happened in Paris, that terrible thing in Paris, he didn't even go. He was the only one of the major nations of the world that didn't show up.
Frank, thanks for checking in. I greatly appreciate it. It's Free for All Friday on The Steve Gruber Show.
The Steve Gruber Show. American values with Midwestern common sense.
Welcome back to it on this Free for All Friday. Steve Gruber with you on the Steve Gruber Show. Glad to have you on board. Working our way through hour number two here. A lot of emotions out there. I mean, if you reflect on those images of the president doing the wave and cajoling with a dictator, a murderous dictator, I might add, while Americans lay dead in Brussels, 300 maimed and murdered. And he gives his standard nonsensical answer, and that's all we get. So, there you go. Here's something else for you to shift gears to something else of importance here today that has been going on for a long time. In a blistering rebuke of the Internal Revenue Service, a Cincinnati-based federal appeals court has ordered the IRS to quit stalling and to produce the names of organizations it targeted based on their political leanings. It is about time. It is a unanimous ruling by a three-judge panel of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Sixth Circuit. It gave the IRS just 2 weeks to turn over the documents sought as part of a class action lawsuit brought by the NorCal Tea Party Patriots. The lawyers in the Department of Justice have a long and storied tradition of defending the nation's interests and enforcing its laws, read the opinion in part. The conduct of the IRS's attorneys in the district court falls outside that tradition. Now, from one of the attorneys present for the Citizens for Self-Governance, we are pleased that the Sixth Circuit had smacked down the IRS and its thuggish Department of Justice lawyers, adding that he believes the Internal Revenue Service is an unredeemable organization. Unredeemable organization. All right, so the NorCal Tea Party, just to give you some background here, sued the IRS in 2013 after a Treasury inspector concluded the IRS had unfairly singled out for extra scrutiny conservative groups applying for tax-exempt status. Barack Obama used the IRS as a weapon against his political opponents. That's the bottom line. The Obama administration, whether he directed it personally himself, which he probably didn't because I'm sure he was golfing, but he set forward this series of events and the atmosphere to create an atmosphere where political opponents could be attacked by the IRS. Now, for their civil suit, the NorCal Tea Party Patriots had requested information from the IRS detailing the organizations targeted. Information they say they have not received or has been wrapped up in legal red tape since 2013, and the panel of the federal judges flat out agreed. I mean, this is a hard slap. Now, here's another part of the written decision from the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals in Cincinnati. The lawsuit has progressed as slowly as the underlying applications themselves. At every turn, the IRS has resisted the plaintiff's request for information regarding the IRS's treatment of the plaintiff class, eventually to the open frustration of the district court. Now, the IRS has pushed back on these allegations and maintained that its handling over the names and organizations on its Be on the Lookout list would violate privacy laws. A lower district court has twice ordered the IRS to produce the documents. In response, the IRS has sought a writ of mandamus to block the order. But Tuesday's angry reprimand by the federal appeals court is clear. Judge Raymond Kethledge wrote this, and this is important because this goes to the heart of how we run our republic. It really does. It goes to the heart of how we holding people accountable. And you cannot use the IRS to go after your political opponents. All right, from Judge Raymond Kethledge now. The district court ordered production of those lists and did so again over an IRS motion to reconsider. Yet almost a year later, the IRS still has not complied with the court's orders. Instead, the IRS now seeks from this court a writ of mandamus, an extraordinary remedy reserved to correct only the clearest abuses of power by a district court. We deny the petition. The panel of judges again gave the IRS just 2 weeks to hand over the documents. In the 17-page opinion, Kethledge laid out a list of requests NorCal made to the IRS that were either ignored entirely or stuck in a legal runaround. In one, the IRS demanded NorCal provided 3,000 pages of what the Inspector General called unnecessary information. In turn, the IRS then claimed it would be unduly burdensome for it to provide such information. Let me tell you something. This is an important decision and a big case. Now, they may try to appeal elsewhere, but I don't believe they can at this point. At this point, they're caught. At this point, the IRS is caught. As well they should be. As well they should be. All right, catching up, if you're just jumping on board, at least two Americans now confirmed dead in Brussels in the terror attacks there. There might be one or two more. But a brother and sister working in Brussels, killed in the attack. Killed in the attack, and it's been confirmed now that they were standing in line, the young man talking to his mother, when the line just went dead. The family has been informed, of course, the family has been informed of the death of these two young people. And this happened at the time, of course, when Barack Obama was out, you know, playing glad hand with a dictator in Cuba, a murderous dictator, while the family of Alexander and Sasha Pinskowski were hearing nothing from their relatives. And now we know that that's because they're in line at the Delta counter waiting to fly home. Just it's maddening, frankly. It's Free for All Friday on the Steve Gruber Show. I'll be right back.
Delivering Michigan common sense with a big dose of truth and honesty.
Welcome back to it. It is Free for All Friday. The hotline is open. It's got your name on it. Actually, it's got my name on it, but that's not important now. What's important now is that the number is 888-900-9966. 888-900-9966. Take a detour now into the problems affecting Flint, its water supply, its lead levels, the cleanup, and the future. Where do we go from here? The governor came out with a 75-point plan. It comes with a lot of cash, and despite all of that, Democrats still calling for his head. Our next guest is a Democrat. Well, we don't know if he's calling for his head, but we're going to find out. Jeff Ehrman, a member of the Michigan House of Representatives, representing the 53rd District. Jeff, welcome back.
Good morning, Steve.
How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm doing good, thanks. So, all right. Give me first of all your assessment of the governor's 75-point plan in Flint.
Well, you know, I think it's great whenever he's coming out with these plans. It shows that he's intending on taking some action. I do feel that the state's response has lacked the urgency and completeness that I would like to see, and have been making those kinds of suggestions all along. But I do think there are some good items in that 75-point plan, and I also think that the task force report that he commissioned and that was released this week has some good suggestions in that as well. And I'm hopeful that the select committee that I'm working on with my colleagues is going to, you know, do a proper investigation of what happened so we can try to take some of these action steps to prevent another tragedy like this.
Are you among those that are asking for the governor to resign?
I'm not.
Okay, but your leadership is. But you're not on that side of the fence at this point.
No, I really felt that when I was given the opportunity to be on the Flint Water Investigatory Committee for the legislature, that I needed to step away from, you know, any determination about whether or not it was time for the governor to go, and really just focus on getting to the facts, trying to figure out exactly what happened when, get a full forensic analysis so that we can really get to the meat of what do we need to do to prevent this from happening again. And so I felt I needed to step out of that consideration until, you know, I had a chance to really just dig in fully. That's my work right now, is to get to the facts.
Fair enough. Jeff Ehrman, member of the Michigan House of Representatives, a Democrat from the 53rd District. Jeff, let me ask you this. I've done a lot of reading on this, as a lot of people have. And the one thing I keep coming back to is the federal copper and lead rule, which, if I'm reading this right, the Flint Water Department violated federal law the moment they switched from the Detroit water supply to their temporary supply waiting for their new system to be built, because they didn't have anti-corrosives in the water to prevent from happening exactly what did end up happening, and they did not have a written plan, both of which would be blatant violations of federal law. Now, so my take on this recently has been there was incompetence at the local level. They believed they could handle taking over the water supply, which proved not to be true. But then there was indifference, it seems to me, from both the state level and the federal level for a long period of time. What is your assessment looking at it?
Well, if you read the task force report that came out this week that the governor commissioned, you know, these are the people that the governor put out there to investigate this. What they said about the issue you bring up is that the idea that there was failure at all levels of government it is true, but it is not fair to say that the blame, so to speak, is equally apportioned. The governor's task force said the responsibility here really lies mostly at the state level because it was the DEQ who was responsible for administering the lead and copper rule. They were the ones who bungled and made a number of mistakes and misinterpretations of the lead and copper rule, among other water quality rules. And also, they pointed out that it was the policy of emergency management, of getting rid of local democracy, that really led to that indifference and led to that disconnection between the local people who were coming forward with bottles of brown, smelly water saying, this water isn't right. And they would come to their local elected officials and they would come to the emergency manager, and their local elected officials were powerless to help them. Even though they passed resolutions to try to switch back to DWSD, those were ignored. And the emergency manager wasn't different.
I've not abrogated your democracy. I'm your elected official.
He ignored them too. So that's what the task force said.
Hold on. And I get all that.
Please. Yeah.
But the suggestion somehow that these emergency managers are somehow to blame for all these problems. Flint was in a financial crisis because of 50 years of mismanagement fiscally, socially. The whole damn city was run poorly, and somebody had to step in and do something. So this notion to demonize emergency managers to me is you know, it's beyond the pale. Flint was a disaster. It's still recovering from decades of mismanagement. Am I wrong about that?
I think that the state had an obligation to get involved in Flint and to, you know, help right their financial ship. And I think that there is little disagreement about the idea that the old emergency manager law, the emergency financial manager law we had, that still had some levers of control and accountability at the local level, so that the local officials had some ability to keep things on a level and to provide.
The problem is with Flint and other places is
that
there was no accountability for decades. That's the problem. That's how we ended up there. We were there. It wasn't because the governor wanted to go, hey, I want to take over Flint today. Come on. I mean,
That's not what I'm suggesting. I'm suggesting that local government is important, and it's important because it's eyes and ears on the ground. It's important because they have a personal connection to the people who are being served, and it's important because it's another level of accountability. It's another check and balance. And when we completely, as a legislature, as a state, swept that off the table with the changes in the emergency manager law, that made our emergency manager law weaker in the sense that there's less local accountability. And that was central to the failing in Flint. That was central to the indifference that you mentioned at the state level to the concerns of the local people there in Flint. So, you know, that's what the governor's task force said. They said we need to get better water regulations, we need to get better testing protocols, we need to improve our emergency manager law to inject a little bit more accountability at the local level.
And I don't disagree with that. But if Flint hadn't squandered its own resources for decades, much like many other municipalities, Flint is not alone in squandering.
Yeah, I agree.
And something has to happen.
If you want to go down that road, I think we should. Let's talk about cities like Flint, who at one time, you know, 80 years ago, were booming and bustling, and they were doing great. And what happened was, because of very large economic changes that were worldwide, this whole effect of globalization, where the auto plants moved from cities like Flint and cities like Detroit, they moved further away, eventually they moved to the south, then they moved overseas. These cities were on the receiving end of huge changes in the global economy that were contributing to their downfall. So let me just give you an example. The city of Detroit went from 1.8 million people, almost 2 million people, all the way down to 600,000. And now
also
we're saying that their inability to pay their pension obligations is because of mismanagement? That's just not accurate. Mismanagement and incompetence is a part of the story.
There is some truth to that. Because hold on, you got your part, and I'll give mine.
No, you're right.
It went from 1.8 million people to 650,000. That's correct. It's the only city in world history to go above a million and come back below it, ever. And so they have obligations to keep. But you know as well as I do that sweetheart deals were made between public sector unions and politicians to give them deals that were unsustainable, that were too big, that were, you know, golden parachutes for everybody that we're now picking up the bill for. So there was mismanagement. You're not going to sit there and tell me there wasn't mismanagement. Now, hold on. Can you stick through the break? I'd like to continue the conversation. Jeff Irwin on the line, Democrat from the 53rd District of the Michigan House of Representatives. It's Free for All Friday on the Steve Gruber Show.
Taking a closer look at the stories that affect you most with a big dose of common sense.
All right, it's Free for All Friday. Your phone number to join the conversation, 888-900-9966, 888-900-9966. Jeff Irwin sticking with us, a Democrat from the Michigan House of Representatives from the 53rd District. The conversation being, you know, mismanagement of funds and so forth. And Jeff, I would say this. Obviously, you know, Flint's population has dropped, so has Detroit's. But a lot of the spending habits weren't reined in, I don't think, because there was always this notion that, you know, somebody come along to help them out. And here we are about to bail Flint out because you look at the numbers being spent. What are we talking about? $500 million? I mean, there's all sorts of numbers being flown around, but tens of millions, hundreds of millions of dollars. And not just to remediate the problem with the water lines and to clean up that the infrastructure there, but for investment in infrastructure beyond that, investment in, you know, job creation and so on and so forth. And my question then becomes, what happens when Muskegon calls? And Kalamazoo calls, and Owosso calls, and other cities, including right there where you stake your flag, Ann Arbor has a toxic plume of a different sort in the ground, as you know, creating problems with groundwater. I mean, it's not an endless well of money, Jeff. What do we do?
Yeah, this flood situation, I think, has been a wake-up call for a lot of communities about the state of their water infrastructure. You know, the engineering, the civil engineering community, the public works community has been sounding the alarm about this for as long as I've been involved in government. You know, here in America, we really built an amazing system of public works, sewers, roads, you know, new schools. We built all of these amazing systems that contributed to our economic prosperity and the amazing growth that we experienced during the second half of the 20th century. And now all those investments are starting to get old. You know, a lot of these sewer systems, a lot of these public works departments, you know, they were built, you know, back during the Roosevelt era, and we've never really gone back and said, we need to invest in our sewers, we need to have good water infrastructure, this is essential for our future prosperity, and simply done that. And so now those costs are adding up. It's sort of like what we've done with our roads. You know, we really kind of took a decade or two off of maintaining our roads properly, and now we're
Jeff,
realizing,
I appreciate all that.
That's really expensive.
I appreciate all that. You're sidestepping the question.
The question is,
if we give $500 million to Flint, how do we give $500 million to Saginaw or Kalamazoo or Muskegon? We don't have enough money to do that. And when you start talking about, you know, we're going to do some economic investment, we're going to do some early childhood education investment, we're going to spend some money here. So, Jeff, we don't have that kind of money.
Yeah.
And
well,
so when the next city shows up, the next one, the next one.
We have the money for universal pre-K across the state of Michigan. If we wanted to make that a priority, if we really wanted to invest in early childhood education, we could do that. And I would agree with you, though, that what's happened in Flint is becoming very, very expensive. And we cannot afford to poison another city in the state of Michigan so that we have to have a long-term investment in health assessments and
Here's the problem.
With the health problems that have been created. And
here's the problem, Jeff, and you just put your finger on it, and I'm glad you did. Jeff Irwin on the line with me, a Democrat from the Michigan House 53rd District. The problem environmentally is multi-dimensional in Flint and everywhere else. It's not just the water. It's the paint. It's those General Motors plants that put acetone and other chemicals into the ground. You know that. And there are chemical problems. In fact, there are cities in Michigan right now, from what I read, that have higher incidence of elevated lead in their blood, higher than Flint. And because it comes from other environmental factors, including paint, because lead-based paint was not outlawed until 1978, and you have a lot of communities in the state that are older that have a tremendous amount of lead-based paint. So what are you going to do the next time? You still really haven't answered it. We can talk about pre-K education. That's all fine and well. We still have to have a way to pay for these things, and we haven't addressed the problem. What do we do with the next city that comes along and says, hey, we're broke, and by the way, we have children with high lead levels? How are we going to get there?
Well, this is going to take, you know, some public effort, and I think that what Flint has done is it has really exposed, you know, how much investment is necessary at the local level around issues like water infrastructure, and also just how expensive it can get if you get those issues wrong. So, you know, I do think this is a big challenge for us. You know, how do we handle all of these costs? Well, you know, let's take it a piece at a time. If we're looking at issues like water infrastructure, let's beef up our efforts to assist local governments in getting ahead of these problems. You know, several years ago, back during the 90s, if you remember, we had a real bipartisan coming together on the Clean Michigan Initiative, a ballot initiative in 1998, to put out a large investment to invest in our environment and protecting the Great Lakes and cleaning up toxic sites that companies had abandoned. That was a great effort, and both sides came together to fund those costs. And, you know, we expended those dollars over the course of many years, and now that well is dry. Maybe it's time to go back to the public and make a similar investment like that again in our water infrastructure. But, you know, there's no question that there are hard choices to make about priorities, and, you know, the legislature has to get to work on it. Hopefully this Flint situation has been a wake-up call for communities and the legislature to get serious about these things. You know, if you don't take care of these foundational, fundamental elements of our economic system, like clean water, like good transportation, if you don't take care of those, then the economy isn't going to thrive.
Well, it all starts with the economy, so I'm going to give you one last question here, Jeff Irwin. What about NAFTA? Is that the root of the problems here of plants going to Mexico and so forth? Because you talked about that, how Flint's shrinking, Detroit's shrinking, Michigan losing manufacturing jobs, going overseas. Is NAFTA one of the root problems to you? You've got about 1 minute.
Is it one of them? I think it's one of them. I do think that our trade policy nationally has been less than optimal for the upper Midwest. I don't think that's a controversial statement. And you know, I think that there's more our government could be doing to promote fair trade over you know, unfettered free trade when we allow other countries to compete unfairly with us and therefore beat our companies because of lax labor and environmental rules. You know, I think that's a mistake for our nation. And so,
you know what? That's spoken.
Yeah, go ahead.
That's spoken like a true Donald Trump supporter. I'm just joking. With you, Jeff.
maybe a Bernie board. I don't know.
I greatly appreciate it. I do.
For our nation.
I understand. I got to run, Jeff, but I greatly appreciate it. Stand-up guy you were today, and I appreciate you coming on here because you know we're going to have tough questions and a good conversation. But it was a good conversation, and I appreciate you taking the time.
Oh, absolutely. You have a great morning, and onward and upward.
There you have it. Jeff Irwin, member of the Michigan House of Representatives, representing the 53rd District, a Democrat. You see, Democrats get a fair shake here just like everybody else, despite what some folks on the left might lead you to believe. It's all fair. On Free for All Friday, on the Steve Gruber Show.